thinking is a revolutionary act. Now here's your host, Terry O'Brien. To have another brilliant legal mind, and by another brilliant legal mind, I'm going to have another guest we've had here on Dangerous Leaders Podcast, and he is my friend, Professor William A. Jacobson. He is a clinical professor of law at Cornell Law School, but he's also the founder and publisher of the excellent blog, Legal Insurrection, which just had its 9th anniversary. Welcome, Professor Jacobson, and congratulations on that.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's been too long. You were back on the Terry O'Brien Show back in 2010. I mean, that seems like about a million years ago, everything that's happened since then. I want to circle back to this 9th anniversary post at Legal Insurrection that was written and published anyway October 12th of this year. And the reason I want to is because there's something in the news today that I think is related. And of course, at the time, I don't know if you were thinking of this, but we just had the delight and euphoria and our friends in the corrupt media over General Michael Flynn making a deal with Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor, to plead guilty to a process crime of lying to the FBI. And my take on this is, you know, you look at this and you say, all right, what statutes were violated? Well, the Logan Act. I mean, please, you know, that's never been prosecuted in 200 years. That's crazy. But he could have been charged with failing to register as a foreign agent, I guess. But that's also something that's rarely charged. But neither of those really affect the president. And if they had any kind of conspiracy thing, they would have gotten Flynn to talk about this criminal conspiracy, you know, with the president. That's not there. So my feeling is this legal analysis that I'm engaging in right now is stupid because really it's irrelevant. This is all political. And it's to give the Democrats a cudgel to use against the president. And that circles back to your legal insurrection post from October 12th, because I have to tell you guys in the audience, it's very much of a bring down because it starts out, here's how you start out, Professor. And it's a miracle I kept reading because I wanted to like stick a fork in my face at that point. Thinking through what it will mean to live without institutions. That doesn't sound good. But you go on to say that the thing that really discouraged you was the efforts by the president's opponents and frankly, the people who just hate him to undo the election by undermining the Electoral College. Do you think that this Flynn plea and this whole Mueller prosecution thing is part of that same effort?
Well, it's hard to know what exactly is going on with the special counsel and the prosecution of Flynn. On its surface, it seems like small potatoes. He pleaded guilty to making false statements about his conversations with the Russian ambassador late in the transition period. So nothing on the face of it concerns the campaign. Nothing on the face of it concerns collusion in the election, which is what Mueller was supposed to be investigating. It appears that it's being used as some sort of tool to force something out of Flynn, and we don't know what that something is. So it might be that this is all they can get him on, or more likely he is giving up something, we just don't know what that something is, to allow Mueller to move up the food chain of the Trump either campaign or the Trump administration or Trump transition team. So it's really hard to know. And of course, I do believe that certainly Democrats have put their hopes and dreams in the special counsel to bring down Trump. So that's unquestionable. On the other hand, they couldn't have predicted it when they sought to interfere with our Electoral College. And for me, that really was a defining moment where I recognized that these were not simply political opponents, that some of them at least are actually very dangerous to our system. I mean, it's one thing to be upset that you lost your candidate lost the election. I mean, we've known that feeling multiple times.
Oh, yes.
With Obama. It's also one thing to complain that it wasn't fair. Okay, we've been there before, but it's a very different thing to have an organized effort to intimidate members of the Electoral College, the people, the individuals who actually cast the vote, to try to get them to change their vote versus how most of them are required to vote based on the popular vote in their state. So essentially what it was an attempt to win the election for Hillary, even though she lost it in the Electoral College, by intimidating the electors themselves. And I think that's unprecedented. I mean, I can't say in the history of the Republic that's never happened, but I certainly don't remember it happening. I don't remember anybody when John McCain lost or when Mitt Romney lost said circulating lists of electors and their home addresses and their phone numbers and where they work and encouraging people to contact their employers and to contact them to try to intimidate them. It was so far over the line. And it was an effort which was not simply by a rogue element in the Democrat Party. It was some pretty prominent people who were involved in this. It wasn't official for the Democrat Party, but they certainly didn't seem to criticize it very much. So this, and that is kind of the tenor that has continued for, you know, a year since the election and 9 months since the inauguration, or 10 months since the inauguration, for Donald Trump. Everything is being done to try to undermine the institutions that put him into the presidency by virtue of how people voted.
I agree with you completely. I absolutely agree with you. I agree with you about the unprecedented nature of the efforts to undermine the and intimidate and threaten individual electors. We've certainly seen from the Democrats over the last 15 years efforts to undermine the Electoral College in general, but we have not seen what you're describing as, you know, actually. But remember, I see if you agree with this. I think Barack Obama ushered in an era of lawlessness and a post-constitutional environment.
Well, to some degree, I think that's true. I think that he was always somebody who wanted to win at all costs. I mean, that's how he rose in his political career. Miraculously sealed divorce records of his opponent in Illinois get released to the public. And so I think that he was very much, a cutthroat politician above and beyond normal cutthroat politicians. And I think that carried forward into the administration, mm-hmm. that I think he weaponized the IRS against conservatives. People say, well, there's no proof he ordered Lois Lerner and the others to do this. They didn't need an order, okay? They knew exactly what they needed to do under his administration. And he used rhetoric that if it was used nowadays in terms of his opponents being enemies, et cetera, nowadays when it's used by Trump or Trump supporters, they scream foul. That's so beyond the pale. But Obama's the one who started that sort of rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in many ways, at many different levels, through his use of executive orders to go around Congress on immigration and other areas, I mean, he just did what he wanted. Mm-hmm. It wasn't complete lawlessness. I mean, he didn't turn into a dictator, but he pushed the limits very far. And now a lot of what Trump has done is unwind the executive orders and lawlessness of the Obama administration. And everybody's screaming when Trump undoes things that Obama did. You probably remember too, you and I and everybody else were saying in those days, if you're going to give Barack Obama this power to act like he can rule unilaterally, don't complain when eventually there's a Republican in office. And of course, we never thought it would come this soon. I was prepared for a 30-year winter of Democrats, but it came sooner than we thought. And now they're all screaming, oh, the president's got too much power. The president's got too much power to act unilaterally. We're like, too late. You should have listened to us when we complained about Obama. So we're not really going to pay attention to you because you can't have it both ways and rein in the president when it's a Republican and let a Democrat, run hog wild.
No, and they celebrated his lawlessness. They celebrated the things he did to accomplish their leftist agenda. Just to, I don't know if you remember, Professor, but I'm here in the belly of the beast in Cook County, Illinois, and Barack Obama took out not one, but two opponents for the Senate with divorce records. And I know thank David Axelrod for that. who used to work for the Chicago Tribune. So, you know, and whose father used to write speeches for Stalin. So, you know, that's where that was all coming from. So, yeah, I mean, I just think that the Democrat Party, when it sold itself, sold to the devil when it threw in with Obama. And I think now, you know, we're seeing the hideous results. So, I mean, but as I read this, you know, you talk about all the reasons that you're pessimistic, I would say, and thinking we're going to be without institutions. And you kind of go through all the institutions that have been destroyed and how. And I will put this piece, of course, kids, it'll be in the show notes for this episode of Dangerous Thinkers with Professor William Jacobson. But I guess I would ask you now, now that Donald Trump has won the presidency, he's made tremendous headway with things like regulations. And I think we are going to have a tax bill today. Are you any more optimistic?
Not really, because what I was talking about was more long-term rot as opposed to rot this year. I think the media is just so out of control that it's lost as an institution, the journalist media. The New York Times, really unprecedented, even other journalists are criticizing them, took their opinion Twitter account and is actually essentially lobbying against legislation. So not just running op-eds, okay, or editorials, but actually tweeting out the phone numbers of senators and encouraging people to call them. The things you expect from, you know, an activist group. And that's now the New York Times. And so I think that just epitomizes journalism. They were very much against Trump. They are doing everything they can to undermine Trump and create a crisis atmosphere for him. So I think as a long-term institution, our journalism is gone. I don't know when it's going to come back. And the same is true for academia.
I want to interrupt you there, and I apologize for stepping on you there, but I want to get back to academia. But a couple of things. Number one, the New York Times, I think, has always been an activist group, but now they're sort of unmasked. But number two, as far as journalism, Professor Jacobson, you and people like you, and I hope to some extent podcasts, I mean, I think we're the future of journalism.
Well, I think people have made a dent, but let's face it. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, MSNBC. I mean, the cumulative weight of their ability to set the narrative and to influence matters might be a little less than it used to be, but it's still there. And the New York Times and the Washington Post can drive stories. The Associated Press, you know, what people don't realize is in many ways the Associated Press is the most influential because there are hundreds, if not thousands, probably thousands of local newspapers who can't afford to have their own reporters. So they just regurgitate AP news stories. And the way they frame issues, the language they use, how it's now not in accordance with the AP style to use the term illegal alien or illegal immigrant. Right. These are, now you have to say undocumented. These wording changes that they make are hugely influential.
Agreed.
Because yes, I do believe that the rise of the internet, the rise of blogs, the rise of podcasts has made a dent. And in specific instances can make a difference on a specific issue. But in terms of where the culture is going, and as you recall, Andrew Breitbart famously said that politics is downstream from culture. Mm-hmm. But where the overall political culture is going, these institutions are still enormously, enormously influential. And I think they are pretty much gone forever. There's only one person who could have gone up against them, and it turns out it's Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I mean, the most unexpected person. Because he is somewhat oblivious to their pressure, because he doesn't really care, in a sense, what they think, although he uses it to generate publicity for himself, and because he's so good at manipulating them in terms of news coverage, he's probably the only person who could have pushed back against this combined massive force of the media. And I think he's had an effect. I think that people really recognize, because the media takes his bait so much, and because they've gone so over the top. I mean, with Obama, it was over the top love. Okay. Mm-hmm. With Trump, it's over the top hate. And mm-hmm. I think the media has really embarrassed themselves. And I think that journalism has taken a huge hit in credibility because of that. And so, yes, I do think it's lost as an institution, but that's not to say that there aren't some pushback that could take place. And I think maybe that'll start to happen on a bigger scale. Apparently, there might be conservative media entities, if I'm just blanking out on the name, but a large media conglomerate that owns a lot of local radio and TV stations. Mm-hmm. There's other things that are happening, which I think could be pushback. But nonetheless, I think it's pretty much gone as an institution, particularly if you see who's now working at these major news organizations. They're the people who used to work at the left-wing blogs when Bush was there.
Yeah, that's true.
If you go through the list of people, a lot of them are former left-wing bloggers.
That's
true. Who now have gone mainstream, and they're the ones setting the agenda at these places. The rise of Vox Media, run mm-hmm. by the Ezra Klein and the other so-called journalists.
Oh God!
The ones who conspired during the McCain campaign, and the documents were leaked. They conspired to set the narrative on Sarah Palin nominated.
They did. And I mean, but Ezra Klein is a silly person. Yeah. He's a silly person.
He runs a website that's still highly influential. It's one of the, I don't know if it's top 10 or top 100, whatever it is, but it's a huge website. And it's a website whose media company was founded by the founder of Daily Kos.
Mm-hmm.
People
yes.
don't realize that.
Yeah.
That Marcos, whatever his last name is, is the co-founder of Vox Media, and he ran the most left-wing, outrageous, and still is, website out there, or one of them. And so they've moved into the mainstream, and they control these organizations now, and it shows up in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, no, it's
and that's that's a generational change. That's not something that took place one year.
No.
And it's not going to change in one year.
No, that's probably true. I want to circle back to to academia and something you mentioned in this piece. I'm talking about this 9th anniversary piece at Legal Insurrection. We'll circle back to that about your university, Cornell. But I just want to touch on the fact, just so the audience here understands, Professor Jacobson, my recollection, because I'm a regular reader of Legal Insurrection, is that you were not really supporting Donald Trump back in the day.
During the primary, I supported Ted Cruz. Originally, I supported Scott Walker until he fizzled out and just wasn't ready for national prime time, because I felt that he was somebody who actually accomplished a lot of very conservative agenda items in Wisconsin. And so, not in an official way, not in an endorsement way, but originally, I was hopeful that he would do well on a national stage, and he just didn't. I mean, mm-hmm. he's somebody who plays well as a governor, did not demonstrate that he can play well on a national stage. After that, I was kind of up in the air and eventually came around to Ted Cruz. But yes, I was very critical of Trump during the primary. But when it comes to the general election, you have a choice. And it was either Trump or Hillary. And to me, that was a pretty clear choice.
Yes, absolutely. Binary choices. I always said to people who said the same thing to me, why are you supporting? But it occurs to me as we're talking, and this thought just occurred to me, maybe we're in an era, we've had for so many years such a dominance in the popular culture, this whole celebrity culture that I always bemoan because I don't think it appeals to serious people, but maybe we're in an era where to win, you have to be like this big personality. You can't be like a Scott Walker.
I think you do. I mean, I as much as I like Ted Cruz substantively, I don't know if he would have survived against Hillary mm-hmm. in the general election. In fact, I'll say he probably wouldn't have. The media was so overwhelming that it really took a bigger than life personality like Trump to, outlast that. And it also took somebody who could motivate people who don't normally vote
mm-hmm.
or who, in hindsight, he may have very well been the only one who could survive the media onslaught that wanted Hillary to get elected at any cost.
Without a doubt, that was a page out of Obama's book. That was one of the geniuses of that campaign. They mobilized people whose only experience with voting was texting in on a Tuesday night their favorite American Idol contestant. You know, that's what right. they did. And it's amazing. Now, in this piece, speaking of these institutions that are gone, you mentioned academia, and we've all seen what's happened to free speech on campus. And it's very disturbing because you say here at your own campus, the new president has formed some sort of a task force to, quote, explore legal mechanisms which are available to the university to prevent, address, and counter situations in which protected expression on campus is harmful to those vulnerable to its effects. What the hell does that mean?
Yeah, well, I don't know what that means. The commission or the group she's putting together could be very positive. I mean, if it is to protect free speech, it could be positive. And it's all arising out of a very small number of incidents on campus, the so-called hate incidents, a couple of which it's too lengthy to get into now, but a couple of which are questionable, mm-hmm. but at least one or two of which seem to be legitimate, racially mm-hmm. motivated sort of crimes, that sort of thing. And there was a lot of pressure on her. She has spoken out in favor of free speech. On the other hand, she has this countervailing pressure, which is present on every campus, of inclusiveness mm-hmm. and not upsetting people and having people feel comfortable. And there is a tension between free speech and people feeling comfortable, because free speech may make people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. This commission she's putting together, or this task force she's putting together, could be a positive thing if it has strong protections for free speech. On the other hand, it is concerning. And, you know, I had a bad experience, I don't know if you read about it, at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York, mm-hmm. back in October, where I was invited by a small conservative libertarian group, 15 students on a campus of 2,400 students, and to give a speech about hate speech and free speech after Charlottesville. And a significant portion of the college community, the so-called social justice warriors, went nuts and really lost it. And it was a very horrible sort of scene. I was eventually able to speak under heavy security. I mean, I had two or three security people with me every place I went on campus. They checked bags coming in. And it was just really a complete, and the student government demanded the president prevent me from speaking. God. It was completely outrageous.
Oh, God.
They spread all sorts of rumors and lies that I was bringing, neo-Nazis with me to attack people.
There we go.
I mean, it was insane. and that's what the atmosphere is like on campuses. Oh, it's not every student. It's not probably even a majority of students, but a very vocal 10 or 15% of the student body who have become radicalized. And I think that's the term I want to now use for the social justice people. They've become radicalized on campus. They don't respect the norms that we've always had in our society. They were very explicit in the student newspaper that they consider free speech a tool of white supremacy.
Oh, God.
And that they do not accept it. And that the only thing that matters is the collective good of the college community.
Oh, my God.
To be free from, verbal attack or whatever.
Hello, Rousseau,
so,
right?
Hello,
Rousseau.
And everybody else stays quiet because they're afraid they're going to get turned on.
Oh, my God. Okay? This is unbelievable.
I don't believe the majority of students agree with these people. But if you're a student in college, and I see this at Cornell, conservative or middle of the road students, they just want to keep their head down and survive. They do not want to be branded as racist or homophobic or transphobic or whatever it happens, or Islamophobic, because they express, a mainstream opinion, mm-hmm. Yes, we are entitled to have a border and control it. I mean, that is considered by the social justice people to be, racist. it's really crazy. And so what happens on the campuses is this radicalized 10 to 15 to 20% of the campus who have strong faculty and administrative support have really created a climate of fear on campuses where people are afraid to speak out. So while even though they may technically have the right to speak out, they know that the price to be paid individually from speaking out is too great, and they just keep their mouths shut and they just hope to survive college unscathed and untarred. and with reputation intact. And that's what I think has been lost on the campuses, that it's all nice for the president of a university to say, we support free speech, but the day-to-day reality on many campuses is that people are so afraid of these the radicalized faculty and the radicalized students that they just keep their mouths shut.
Oh, I don't doubt it. Yeah, I don't doubt it. I see it. And yet, our guest, Professor William Jacobson of Cornell, perseveres because that's why you are a dangerous thinker, because you are fearless. One of our guests, Professor Carol Swain, said she's a dangerous thinker because she thinks, which is also true today. But another interesting piece you have at Legal Insurrection was from last month, talking about the potential opportunity for President Trump to get some more conservatives, or maybe get a conservative. Well, I guess I'll count Gorsuch as a conservative on the court. Although I have to bust you a little bit here, Professor. You're talking about the backlog and this whole process of blue slipping by senators where they can, you know, delay a nominee for no reason. And you say Chuck Grassley rips up the blue slip stall. Al Franken left groping for alternative delay tactic. Oh, Professor.
So you appreciated that title.
I did appreciate it. So now I think President Obama did tremendous damage to the federal courts. What opportunity does President Trump have to undo a lot of that?
I might be slightly off on the statistics because they change every day, but it is entirely possible that in the first term, the first 4 years, assuming there's no reelection, that a third to 40% of the federal judiciary could be Trump appointments or nominees.
Wow.
Because there are that many vacancies currently, and between current vacancies and what they call known vacancy, where a judge has announced a future retirement date, there, a third or more could be Trump nominees. And that process has been moving forward quicker than prior administrations, but not fast enough for me to get people nominated through the committee to a floor vote. I expect that in December and January and February, that pace will pick up because it's just a certain time that it takes to get them through the process. It is also anticipated that if Trump were to get reelected, that over half or more of the federal judiciary would be Trump appointments.
You talk about
institutions that have been lost. There is the rare, maybe the only institution that people have a chance to reclaim is the federal judiciary, which we know is hugely important. Mm-hmm. I mean, look how federal district court judges have been able to stymie and, you know, to varying degrees, Trump's travel orders and other things that they've done. Mm-hmm. And as long as they're playing a proper role of the judiciary, that's fine. But you read some of the opinions and they're almost like political manifestos.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Trump recently won the case over who's going to be the interim director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Well, guess what? This wasn't widely reported. I mean, it was reported, but not widely. The judge who decided it was someone Trump had nominated, mm-hmm, and took the federal bench in September.
Yeah, and he's a young guy, too, isn't he? He's a young guy, which is good.
Yeah, he used to be some sort of counsel or some sort of staff or something, I believe, for either Mitch McConnell or Chuck Grassley or a prominent Republican. So when you get these people into positions of power, you're more likely to get a fair shake. Now, the judge correctly ruled with regard to the interim director issue. So I'm not saying that he only ruled that way because he was a Trump nominee, but at least Trump got a fair hearing.
Right.
As opposed to what has happened in some of the lower federal courts, where it's almost like they don't really care. They want a result and they're going to get it.
Oh, my God.
And particularly at the appellate level, the Court of Appeals level, that's where Trump probably will have the greatest impact, because the majority of cases, vast, vast majority, end at the Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court takes, I think, 80 or 100 cases a year out of several thousand, mm-hmm, that are determined at the Court of Appeals level. So it is anticipated that the nature of the judiciary will be substantially rebalanced. I won't even say swung conservative. It will be rebalanced. You have circuits that, like the Fourth Circuit, that used to be known as a very conservative circuit. And then after Harry Reid did away with the filibuster rule for nominees, Obama packed the Fourth Circuit and is now a very liberal circuit. Mm-hmm. And Trump has some opportunity to reclaim these circuits.
Wow. Well, see, Professor Jacobson, doesn't that make you feel better?
A little bit, but not enough.
Well,
I'll feel better when the 100th Trump judge had been approved by the Senate. Right now we're at 8 or 9 or 10.
Oh dear.
When we get to number 100, give me a call back and we'll celebrate.
I will. We'll do a, because we're not in the same location. We'll do like a video call. We'll each have some champagne for that. That's what we'll do for when that day comes. Well, I tell you one thing that makes me feel better is talking to you, Professor William Jacobson, even though I think, this piece you wrote, I can't argue. I can't argue with a lot of the facts you cite, and you're a very clear thinker and a really smart guy. And that's one reason I love talking to you.